Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Raymond Hopkins, professor of political science at Swarthmore College, and we're discussing the causes of continuing hunger. Raymond, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
In order to set the stage for particularly what you want to say about these continuing causes, I think it would be helpful to give the listener a background sense of what the current status of hunger is in the world.
Sure. The Food and Agriculture Organization and most other groups agree that something like 800 million people are undernourished. That is, they don't get enough to eat to live an active, healthy life. And what that really means is they are more susceptible to disease. It means that they can't be engaged in productive work as well. And they mean they are likely to produce children that are themselves flawed in various ways. And so they just aren't able to realize their potential. And within that, there's perhaps 35 million people who are acutely hungry, some of whom now are in Afghanistan, but scattered in other countries as well, who, because they're so in little food available to them, they're likely to die unless something happens.
Okay, so the two related problems here. One is just some sort of consistent undernourishment, and that may lead to death, but even if it doesn't lead to death, there are considerably important effects of that malnutrition in terms of their ability to carry on a productive life, to work. Now, has this tendency improved? Are there fewer people who are hungry now than in the past? More? How has it changed, say, over the last 30, 40 years?
Well, Hugh, this is what's really interesting, is that looking particularly at the developing world, where most of these people are located, the absolute number of food insecure or hungry people has declined. That is, the estimates were in the mid-60s to mid-70s that perhaps over 900 million people, and that was out of a population of 4 to 5 billion, were undernourished. The current estimate of roughly 800 million is among 6 billion people, so that the fraction in the world is going down and the absolute number has gone down. And that's true for every region of the world with one exception, and that's Africa, where the absolute number has gone up, and indeed it looks like the percentage of the population has gone up.
So it looks as if there certainly is at least some ability to deal with the problem of widespread hunger. I mean, the fact that the absolute numbers and certainly the relative numbers have gone down.
Right. Thanks to technology, partly the Green Revolution, to better infrastructure, both irrigation and roadways, farmers are able to grow considerably more, particularly in areas in Asia, which, because of the large population, were in the 60s and 70s facing severe malnutrition. India, even today, with over a billion people, has an estimated number as high as 200 million, one quarter of all those now in the world undernourished. But even so, India's made great strides in that they're no longer dependent on food imports, so they're no longer dependent even to maintain the population at this very precarious level, at least a part of their population. So that technology, improved infrastructure, improved education in some cases, better opportunities for marketing that has occurred in the last decade, dramatic stories in places like China and Vietnam where agricultural production has gone up substantially. All of those kind of success stories are important in understanding how the world has evolved in a very positive way. Basically, food prices are lower now than they have been in a century on average. International trade of food is fairly inexpensive because of container ships. International commercial bodies can move food around fairly promptly, so that any country that's reasonably well off can import food they need, even if they have a short-term shortfall or if they're a chronic deficit country. The Japanese eat very well, thank you, and they have very high prices of food that they protect within the Japanese market, but they're a rich country. So the real problem of hunger now is also a problem of poverty in many cases, and improved technology, improved economic growth in a number of countries has made the problem a lot less serious. There are countries with extraordinary inequality, like Brazil, which, although they have plenty of money in the country to feed everyone, because of the high level of inequality, still have a large portion of the population that are undernourished. And it's those kind of problems that are very difficult to deal with, because Brazil is not a country that will get food aid, either on an emergency, but even on a regular basis, because they're too well off. So we've got a series of problems in the world, from emergency situations to chronic inequality in some countries, to cases like Bangladesh, which is a very, very poor country and is not able, because of flooding and other conditions, to, on a sustained basis, have adequate food security, and they can't afford to bring enough food in on a commercial basis. So they're a chronic recipient of food aid.
Maybe this requires more details than you have close to hand, but it occurred to me when you were talking about it, you said there are some clear success stories, and you mentioned right off the bat China as a clear success story. And you also said that Africa was the one place in the world where the problem had gotten worse in the past 30 years. I think it might be interesting to compare China and Africa. Obviously we're comparing a country to a continent here, but what happened in China that was so positive, and what has not happened in Africa that perhaps could have changed the number of people who are impoverished there?
Well, China really had two important changes. One was they broke up through land reform under Mao in the 1950s, the old estate system, which was exploitative. But they put in a system of agriculture that was also repressive in terms of incentives for farmers. They did try and adopt new technologies so that the Green Revolution was always encouraged. But beginning in the late 1970s, they shifted to a system where farmers had an incentive to look after their own crop, take care of their land, and to grow in order to get income from their products in a way that they hadn't been before. So first, the relative equalization of land opportunity, and then the shifting of that land opportunity to an individual incentive in the 80s, created an opportunity for China to move ahead. That, married with the introduction of Green Revolution technologies, particularly the new seeds, allowed China to become an extraordinarily large producer of particularly rice, but also wheat and corn. They're one of the largest producers of all those commodities in the world. So that's the story there. In Africa, on the other hand, you didn't have the kind of barriers of land inequality as in China that occurred in the first half of the 20th century. But what you did have was post-colonial governments coming to power and inheriting a sense that the state should organize and run markets. And the impact of that was to discourage agricultural production. Added to that, there has been a 20 to 30 year decline in the kind of climatic conditions that are helpful to agriculture. There's been a series of droughts throughout the upper part of the sub-Saharan area, the Sahelian belt. There have been serious floods. So a country like Mozambique, which has gone through both a kind of a series of shocks through civil war, which is the third thing I'll mention, and a disruption of their agriculture because of an effort by the state to kind of run it in ways that would discourage the individual farmer. But thirdly, in the last decade, they've had a couple of floods and then a drought, all of which has hurt their agriculture. So you have in Africa then a set of government policies that have been adverse to agriculture, some of which have been corrected in the last decade. You have a series of climatic conditions, which have been very deleterious. You thirdly have a legacy, I didn't mention before, of soils which are not nearly as productive as, for example, in our own American Midwest. And then you have civil strife and conflict, which terribly disrupts the population, but also undercuts the capacity to farm regularly. All four of those factors combined led to the deterioration of a per capita, so with population growing quite rapidly in Africa, the per capita food availability began to decline in many countries in the 1970s and continued declining. For many, some have turned that around in the last 5 to 10 years.
I think maybe we're going in the direction of what I was hoping to explore next, which is why we haven't had more success than we have. When I hear the explanation you just gave of the two countries, when you gave the explanation of China, it was first that there was this land reform that gave more people a chance to own land, and then secondly there were changes which encouraged people perhaps to be better stewards of their land in terms of producing enough food to sell for profit. And in the case of Africa, the first thing you mentioned was mistakes by governments. It sounds in both cases as if the governments turn out of the countries themselves turn out to be incredibly important in determining whether that country will have a large number of people who are impoverished or not. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. As a political scientist, it's indeed, I think, an important point to understand that even if China, with its superior soils and, in general, more favorable climatic conditions, had had the kind of predatory practices on marketing that Africa experienced, it seems to me there's no way they could have had the enormous growth rates of 4 to 6% annually in yields from the mid-80s through the mid-90s. The highest in the world, really, for that era. And I think that, therefore, the key really is good policies that reflect an environment where farmers are going to want to respond and feel confident that their efforts will be rewarded. But, of course, political stability occurred in China, where the political conditions were falling apart in many African countries. And, of course, there are these other factors, so it's certainly not a single-factor explanation.
Again, it sounds as if the best explanation isn't just that people are starving because they're lazy, that the problems are far broader than the choices and actions of a particular individual or a particular family.
Absolutely. In fact, I mean, firstly, I mean, you think about you and me and everyone else. If you're hungry, it comes to your mind within 24 hours that it's a very high priority to get something to eat. People don't leave their land where they've lived for years and give up their household possessions when they're refugees, as they have done occasionally in drought conditions, in order to get food, except for that vital necessity of it. And even if it's a short-term problem or something that you can handle far short of an emergency, there's virtually no one who isn't really to work hard. You should see the number of hours that men and women in Africa put in agriculture. We're talking 60 to 90 hours hard work every week, week after week, backbreaking work. These people are not in any way undeserving with respect to the energy and commitment. It's just that they're faced with very unhappy circumstances, ones that you and I would be, eager to run away from if we had a choice.
I want to continue on these themes in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause just a moment. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Raymond Hopkins, professor of political science at Swarthmore College, and we're discussing the causes of continuing hunger. One of the things I think it would also be helpful to elaborate on just a bit here, it's something you've mentioned several times, but it seems to me to be very important in thinking about both the incidence of hunger and what we might do about it. Is in some cases you refer to short-term or acute hunger that's caused by a drought, a flood. And then you've also talked about chronic hunger, the hunger that the people just never really escape. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what that distinction is and why it's so important for our thinking about how we should approach this problem.
Much of the attention of people in the wealthier countries, certainly in the United States, is on these emergency situations, getting food into the 6 million people affected by possible famine this winter in Afghanistan. And that deserves priority attention. It deserves spending 4 or 5 times the amount on per-delivered food in Afghanistan compared to regular kinds of food aid deliveries, because the emergency requires all that kind of extra transportation and overhead costs. But because that diverts both our attention and our resources, what happens is that people in chronic hunger, people who might have some chance of making that number of 800 million, as the goal was set several years ago, be reduced in half, a reasonable goal. You're never going to get hunger to zero, perhaps, but to get it down into the 400 or 500 million range, that itself would be an enormous achievement. And to do that requires a lot of effort by the coordinated policies of the World Bank, the UN system, major countries in Europe and the United States, prodding these countries, providing them assistance to reorganize their agricultural sector, putting in infrastructure, helping them with research so they can take advantage of new technologies. Now, that effort often is under-supported, dramatically so. We're putting less funding into helping these countries in agriculture, in organization after organization, and the reason for that is the political priority given to other now dominant objectives. And the most recent wave of terrorism, as we've tried to respond to it, is only making that situation worse. So that almost all the resources tend to be that are available, let's say, for helping people in human need, are being absorbed into the emergency sector. The World Food Program, for example, in the early 1980s gave something like 80% of their food assistance to long-term sustainable projects. That number is now down to about 15 to 20%. So the vast majority of their aid is going into emergencies. And while those demand our priority, it means that since they have a relatively fixed amount of food aid available for them in the current world, that there's less going into helping people develop more sustainable ways to work their way out of this undernutrition or food insecurity situation.
So the difference between what we need to do for the two kinds of hunger is just not the same. That in the case of emergency aid, what's needed, and perhaps all that's needed, is food, some kind of short-term support. In the other case, in the case of chronic hunger, what's needed is something more substantial, which leads to the term I think you've used several times, is development within the country.
Yes, although I would put it somewhat differently. I'd say that there is a problem in that the political support, the kind of galvanization of will that's in Congress or in international agencies to respond and have the resources to do so, arises in these emergency situations. We saw it in the mid-1980s in Africa. I think we're going to see it now with respect to Afghanistan and perhaps a few other cases. What happens in those cases, though, is that you, as you phrase it, all that's really needed is these countries have had a terrible shock, either because of political violence or because of bad weather, and we bring some food in, and that will take care of their problem. In my view is that what that should signal is that you begin with the emergency thinking that this is going to be a 10 or 15 year operation where you phase out of high expensive deliveries of emergency food aid and you shift over to regular less expensive food aid, and then you shift over into turning that food aid or other resources into kind of sustainable development interventions and cooperative arrangements with those countries, and particularly in Africa or a place like Afghanistan, you begin to build institutions of restraint that provide a framework of stability, a state that's actually a state and not a predatory group of people following some weird agenda or some personal enrichment patterns, as you see in Angola or in Congo and other countries in Africa. And I think one could say with the Taliban in Afghanistan, I think we have to take a responsibility in the developed world for preventing people from being exploited in that way. And part of that prevention means putting in place instrumentalities to help people develop themselves institutions of restraint. In our country, one of the greatest institutions of restraint over the years has been the individual ownership of land by farmers who could therefore not only feed themselves but feed others, do it through a private market, and could stand up and make many, many claims on the government with a kind of independence, a kind of check on the government that was built into our social fabric. And that's what's missing in many countries. Hence, you can see I'm putting my politics hat on.
No, I think you...
Food, hunger, and politics really are very closely related.
It sounds as if the main problem then, the main reason we have starvation is are all traceable to some degree or another to factors entirely within the institution, within the country in which hunger occurs. That you have corrupt or predatory leaders, that you have some kind of natural catastrophe. And the problem is to be located within each country, and the main thing other countries can do is perhaps give them aid and direction. I believe the phrase you used, tried to stop people from being the subject of predation by leaders. Is that right, that the main problem is internal to each country?
Yes. I would say that if you said that it's the responsibility of each sovereign state to use these resources of the country to meet certain basic needs of people, whether they're civil freedoms or basic economic rights. No one should starve in any country in the world when we have vast amounts of food-producing capability in the modern world, vast amounts of inexpensive transportation facilities that can be brought to bear, that even the poorest country in the world is able to at least open its mouth and say, we could use some food provided because there are agencies that are available to help them solve that problem. So that there's plenty of food in the world, the distribution mechanisms are generally available, there's general public support for this as a priority over other kinds of foreign assistance. And yet, when we see the figures, we say, well, what in the world is going on? Why aren't there improvements being made? And I would say there are two basic reasons. The one you cited, that is a failure of the internal, often governmental apparatus of those governments or states to take the responsibilities that they should shoulder and do the right thing. But also, at the international level, often, as I mentioned, these dramatic instances that capture people's attention and therefore a willingness to commit to a long-term program of making the country's foods self-reliant, that is, to have enough economic or other resources that they can grow their own food or they can afford to buy it on the market. And that's a basic goal that many senators, Bob Dole and George McGovern, just started a renewed initiative on this issue that has been talked about a lot, but it's never really been put into place. So there's a failure of what we call collective action. Lots of individuals would say, well, we'd like to do this, but there's no kind of business interest that's strong enough. ADM and others will talk about how they're, you know, have willingness to feed the world, but in fact, the world first has to have the economic growth before they're relevant, and I don't think we understand fully what that means, as a public obligation. So I would call this a failure of what's called collective action in my discipline. The other is that many of the agencies themselves are just not well configured to do everything that needs to get done. They can do bits and pieces, and oftentimes only in a short-term way, and they make mistakes. And what happens is when an agency makes mistakes, they get blamed. And so there's a kind of failure of the internet, of the public sector institutions at the international level, whether they be Save the Children or Catholic Relief Service, CARE, which are very good NGOs in our country, or whether they be the World Food Program or the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization. None of them can have a record that is so strong that people will immediately say, oh, well, this is a wonderful agency. I'll devote a large share of my resources to it, whether you're an individual or a government. It just hasn't happened.
One of the things you said a moment ago, we've just got about 4 minutes here to explore a couple of final issues. One of the things you mentioned a moment ago was a viable economy within the country. Certainly one thing which many people would want to push is to say, well, all we need to do is to have free markets. And if we have free markets within these countries, then that's going to solve the problem. Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about something more?
Something substantially more. You need feeder roads and irrigation. I mean, the Chinese case was that the Chinese government provided stability with an authoritarian regime that we don't really approve of, but nonetheless, not only did they provide stability, but they provided roads, they provided the kind of irrigation systems that were vital to the high productivity of the Chinese farmers. There's very little irrigation in Africa because it requires political organization that's not there. It's also not suitable in some areas. You need, therefore, this kind of public infrastructure, the research, the extension services that we have in the United States that we take for granted, our public sector investments that were crucial to the enormous success of the American farmer and the fact that the U.S. is the leading exporter of food in the world. Countries in Africa, countries in Central America, some of the poor countries in Asia don't have that public sector capability. And until they develop that, they're not going to be able to overcome their problems. So it's a combination of getting the policies right and allowing the market to operate and giving incentives to individual farmers. So that's the market part of it, the private sector part of it. But there's a public sector responsibility, and both of those are missing in many African countries.
You indicated that for whatever reason, people in the affluent nations don't seem to be willing to support either directly through their governments or indirectly through private contributions the efforts either to have the kind of political stability that you think they need to have, the supplying of infrastructure which they need to have, or to change the markets within those countries. What can we do? I mean, you mentioned, for example, the Dole McGovern Initiative. Is that a way to move ahead, or are there other alternatives you would like to suggest?
Well, that's one way. And if I had a solution that I was clear on, I guess I'd be less focused on my academic life and teaching courses on this topic and more out doing stump campaign speeches. But I do think that we have to overcome the kind of problem that plagues us again and again, where we don't individually deny that there's a reachable goal to reduce hunger, but we expect that other agencies will take care of it. And just like, for example, with the issue of campaign finance reform, for example, there's a vast majority of people who support it, but it's very, very hard to get through Congress because there's a few vested interests that are not in favor of it. You don't have so much vested interests facing us with respect to the hunger issue, but we do have this dilution of individual responsibility not being able to translate into some kind of collective action. Sorry about that. It'll go away in a second.
We just have a few seconds here. How much do we give to help other people in the world?
The United States' total foreign assistance as a fraction of our gross national product is about between 0.1% and a little bit less, which is about half or a third what most of the other countries that are rich industrial countries, Japan and Europe, do currently. We're about 0.1% of what, say, countries like Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and the Netherlands give. So we're about 0.1% of those countries, and it's a tiny fraction of our government budget. Our total 150 as all foreign assistance for State Department efforts, for all kinds of international initiatives, for paying the salaries of all the international people employed by the U.S. government, is about $25 billion. Perhaps half of that is in foreign aid. So it's somewhere in the $12 to $15 billion range. And some of that is just directly going into countries who we favor politically or militarily, and we're also providing them with military assistance out of a different program. So not all of that by any means is going into trying to eradicate hunger.
Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Well, thank you, and look forward to some feedback from some of your listeners.
Okay. I've been speaking today with Raymond Hopkins, professor of political science at Swarthmore College. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.